The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Are we seeing the slow and steady and perhaps inevitable consolidation of thought at the hands of both big government and big tech, at the hands of big government working with big tech? There's evidence that the public is still resistant, so they're taking their time. The evidence of the resistance we talked about with Professor Humphreys from Stanford yesterday, a University of Maryland Washington Post survey that finds that two-thirds of Americans either would be unable or unwilling to use a virus alert platform under development by Apple and Google as a joint. And of course, there's still a disposition to free speech and free thought culturally, even while the restriction of free speech and free thought is tolerated in large parts of our country, college campuses, even in a distance learning environment, obviously Hollywood, and on social media platforms. And in fact, this was the thrust of Dennis Prager and Adam Carolla's documentary, No Safe Spaces, wasn't it? And Dennis Prager particularly knows the sting of what he's discussing, considering how his Prager University videos have been censored on YouTube. For more on the topic, as Facebook and Twitter methodically march forward in this direction, despite the criticism, despite offering paeans to free speech in congressional committee testimony, pleased to be joined by Khalif Lataru, who's a Real Clear Media Fellow and Senior Fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security, who's written about Facebook's new evidence-free rating system. Khalif, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. So let's start with your piece at realclearpolitics.com about Facebook's false, quote-unquote, rating system. And you give a very easy-to-follow case study in terms of how an opinion can quickly become false if it's the wrong opinion.
Yeah, you know, it's actually a really interesting story. So last month, Emmy Award-winning journalist Cheryl Atkinson shared this video on Facebook. You know, she immediately, you know, Facebook sent her this notice saying that, you know, you've shared quote-unquote fake news, we're notifying your followers, you can be, have all kinds of bad things happen. And when she went there and clicked on the link that says, you know, why is this thing deemed fake news, it pointed her to this website, I believe it was Health Feedback, which is this fact-checking site that wasn't actually fact-checking that video at all. It was actually fact-checking a New York Post opinion piece. And what's interesting about this is the actually under Facebook's own rules, it's actually a really interesting story because under Facebook's own rules, A, opinion pieces can't be fact-checked, and B, one of the two fact checkers that reviewed this and found, declared that these things were false, actually worked at the lab in question. So this video was about, what are the possible origins of the COVID-19 virus? Is it possible that it might have escaped from a lab in Wuhan? And it's interesting because one of the two fact checkers in her own response says, you know, I've worked at this lab for 2 years, and so I believe that this is false. And it's a really interesting thing that, you know, people involved with surge, we think of fact checkers as these objective people on these, you know, essentially objective experts that are, you know, have deep knowledge that are objectively reaching out and looking at things. Versus here, we have a case of someone actually involved in the story, so to speak, rendering judgment on it. And it's an opinion piece to boot. But yet, despite all of that, this is actually being used in the real world to say, hey, you know, anyone that shares these things, this is fake news, and we're going to notify your followers, your purveyor of fake news. We're going to take potentially all these sanctions against you. So it's this really kind of, we have this veneer of fact checkers objectively telling us what's true. But when you pull the curtain aside, essentially, you see it's not nearly what they make it out to be.
And just in terms of how this then is pushed through the system, once it's declared false by the fact checker, than anybody who shares the story. It's also that designation follows their sharing.
Exactly. So what happens with Facebook is they have these partners of fact-checking sites. All around the world, they have all these different organizations that they've designated as fact-checking partners. So what happens then is Facebook or the organization can say, here's a story that we believe needs to be reviewed. Then they have fact-checkers. People go through it, and then they cast a judgment on it. And they say it's true, it's false. They have actually a whole bunch of different ratings. They can say it's mostly true, it's mostly false, it's true but needs context. But essentially, what you have then is a fact checker can go in, say this story is false, and from that point forward, anyone that shares that story on Facebook is declared to be a purveyor of fake news.
Well, let's pick it up there when we come back with Khalif Littaru, RealClearMedia.com fellow. Want to talk about whether or not the rules for these social media platforms are really, there are no rules. There's just a market position we're trying to drive. More with Khalif Littaru right after this.
Fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're talking about Khalif Littaru. He's a RealClearMedia.com fellow, senior fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. And we're talking about the regulating of content that Facebook and Twitter, the social media, big social media platforms do, particularly in the space of policy and politics. Khalif, let me just start with, before we get to Twitter, because I want to get your view on Twitter's designations now of disputed. But generally speaking, do we have here Facebook and Twitter, Google, YouTube? Here are our rules, you know, in defense of quality content and fair play and consistent with the principles of free speech, so long as there's, you know, no appeal to prurient or hateful interests. Those rules are set forward. But then in terms of the actual implementation, the message is simple for the minders, which is we want to eliminate content that we disagree with and we want to drive content that we agree with.
You know, that's what makes these stories so fascinating is on the surface, what the social media companies are doing sounds perfectly fantastic. We're going to get rid of horrible, you know, hate speech. We're going to get rid of falsehoods. We're going to ensure that people see real, you know, high quality, non-hateful information. The problem is, how do you define that? Who defines what's real and what's false? Who defines, I mean, it's sort of very Orwellian, 1984, of, you know, what's real and what's false? What's acceptable speech that we're permitted to talk about or acceptable beliefs and what's not acceptable? And what's interesting here is, you know, liberal democracies like the United States, you know, we've debated these issues for over the centuries. We've come up with a very expansive, essentially, protections for free speech. Other than a handful of cases, a U.S. citizen is allowed to do a lot of things. What's interesting here is private companies, all of a sudden in the last 10 or 15 years, you know, you have these social media companies that have really stepped forward and said, the government may allow you to say anything you want, but we're going to come up with our own rules for what you're permitted to see and say on our platforms. And the average person today, you hear from your elected official, probably through Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, et cetera, social media. You talk to them oftentimes on social media. You know, our public debates about where we want our country to head occur on social media. So, you know, the public square that's so crucial to democracy, that's in private hands now with these companies where tomorrow Mark Zuckerberg can say, hey, you know what? I don't agree with this idea. I don't want people to talk about that. Flip a switch and suddenly it disappears. Like you saw with Facebook banning posts that encouraged certain types of reopening protests. Facebook simply said, we're not going to allow people to discuss or organize those here.
Well, right. And of course, the argument would be from the free market side that, hey, look, they built it and you came. So it's their private platform and they're allowed to make the rules for your participation. And I'm somewhat sympathetic to that, but there still are contract rights issues. There are still issues with respect to commercial fraud. If you're promulgating rules of use and you're not abiding those rules of use. And that seems to me what we're seeing, where hate speech will soon become statements like "I disagree" will soon become hate speech. I mean, it is effectively the de facto consolidation of opinion, the enforced unanimity of opinion when it comes to things like, as you were just describing, COVID-19 related policies. And I'll tell you, too, it's not just the fact that we have these rules, but the rules are there are no rules in terms of their application, also in terms of their non-application. So, for example, I posted a story on Facebook just to personalize it. It's the first time it's ever happened to me. I posted a story where there was somebody had identified that a California news outlet and a Jacksonville, Florida news outlet used the same picture of people on the beach to essentially push the idea that beaches shouldn't be reopened because people are on the beaches and they're not social distancing. Same picture in California and Florida outlets. And it was, in fact, used on those two outlets. But the dispute from Facebook was that's misleading because there was some sort of technical glitch that resulted in that same picture being used in the Florida story that was used in the California story. But they didn't flag the stories themselves and the technical glitch and provide that context. They just flagged it when somebody else repurposed the story to make a point that the story was misleading. So I'm misleading for posting about it, but the original post isn't misleading. It's that sort of stuff where the standards are applied depending on the perspective being driven that is concerning if people don't understand it and may ultimately be their undoing or provide for what conservatives have talked about for a long time, which is the rise of a competitor in that space that actually is committed to free communication on their platform.
You see, that's actually exactly the point of my piece, and that's actually a fascinating and unfortunately all too common case where, you know, one of the problems these companies, you know, despite the fact that they're literally defining what's true and false for society now, they, you know, there's no transparency into what they do. When they get things wrong, you know, like even like in this particular case, you know, Facebook's own rules say an opinion piece cannot be fact-checked, period. And here's a fact checker that took an opinion piece and did it. So they violated
and declared it false. Right.
It took weeks for the New York Post to finally get Facebook to, you know, quietly change the ruling. But even then, you know, Facebook didn't issue a public statement saying, hey, you know, we got this wrong. We apologize. There's no transparency. So when these things go wrong, we have no visibility into that. And we don't even know, like in this particular case, for me as an information scientist, when I see, hey, you know, this is someone associated with the Wuhan lab that's rendering judgment on a story involving that lab, you know, that's just completely antithetical to this whole idea of a neutral,
impartial,
you know, a neutral, independent third party. And, you know, it's just this whole world of, and, you know, again, to your point, well, you know, they're walled gardens, you know, we don't have to use Facebook or Twitter, but you actually almost do today. You know, you think about the president of the United States, you know, President Trump, he's on Twitter. If you want to reach the president of the United States, you have to use Twitter. Yes, you could write a letter and hope it doesn't get lost in the, you know, the White House mail room. Or you could just tweet directly to the president. And that's the problem. These are the platforms that reach almost all of the major members of Congress now. They're on social media. That's how you talk to your elected officials today. You know, local government here in Washington, local government, it's Twitter. It's their Facebook pages. That's where you have to go to even find out, you know, are the roads going to be open tomorrow? Yeah. You know, it's all social media. So really, government has adapted. Social media is essentially the way we communicate with our government now, so we can't avoid it. And that's a fascinating thing.
And Trump on the center right, Trump is about the only one on Twitter who's too big to be censored, at least for now. He is Khalid Lataru. He's RealClearMedia.com fellow and senior fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. Khalid, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.